Radio Arthur. We radio the artists.
So, for this chosen artist, we are now sitting in our kitchen together with Quinn Latimore, who is just introducing herself right now.
Okay. So, I'm Quinn Latimore, and I'm a poet and critic from Southern California. I'm originally from Venice Beach, and then I went to school in New York, where I ended up living for many years and working for different magazines, including art magazines. And then I've recently moved to Basel about a year ago, and and I'm writing about art from here for magazines like Frieze and Art Forum and Art in America. And I'm going to talk about Valley Export's 1970s series, Body Configurations in Architecture, tonight, because it's a body of work that I discovered pretty early in terms of kind of my artistic development. And I think it's influenced both my poetic writing in terms of my poetry and also my criticism and the way, and my aesthetics, the way I look at bodies of visual art. So, the series is often English called Body Configurations in Architecture, but it's actually just called Body Configurations. And the original body of work was from 1972 to 76, although there's some related pieces that were made in the 80s. And I first became aware of this work about 10 years ago in 2000, which was right around the time that I graduated from college. And there had been, Valley Export wasn't super well known in the US at that point, but just around that time, there was a large retrospective of her work in Philadelphia. And although I didn't get to see it on one of my trips home, I saw an article about her work in Modern Painters, which was one of my mom's art magazines. And my mom cut out or ripped out one of the images from the article and put it above her desk so that she could look at it. And I kept noticing it on the trip home. And the piece was called Encirclement from 1976. And in the image, the artist Valley Export is laying along a curb in a street. And it's a black and white photo. And her body is wrapped around the long, slow curve of the street curb. And all you can see is her body, and then below it are some lines, and above it are some lines of the concrete. And then on top of the image, she drew a red line of ink, which followed the curve of her body, which was also the long, curving trajectory of the street. And I was really taken with the aesthetics of the image. It was black and white, a little soft, with these strict architectural lines. And then there was the artist's body, which was also strict, but not quite. It was obviously alive and breathing and human, but its proximity to the architectonics of the street completely changed it. The architecture was cold and concrete and European, and it felt a little bit dead, but it was also not quite that. I think the paradox of her body against the architectural setting created a kind of mutability, so that I saw the lines of division between her and it, and yet the proximity created a kind of understanding and between her and the architecture, between bodies and architecture, and specifically female bodies. I think it was really important that her body was female, and I think I was responding to that very much. Anyway, so that was the understanding that I was drawn to, that it was a woman's body, which is probably the ideal of beauty and image in Western art, maybe Eastern art as well, but definitely Western art. And then there was the sort of ugly, cold architecture, which in proximity to her body could also be beautiful. And the fact that this female body, which was lovely and long, could be reduced to something like the architecture, which was immense and stationary and menacing and yet kind of banal the way the picture was taken, really affected me in a way that I didn't quite understand at the time because I was kind of young and I hadn't I hadn't started studying art yet. I had no idea I would be an art critic at some point. Anyway, so I started doing some investigation about the larger series of works, and basically this series of photographs, this is what she does. She inserts her body or someone else, but it's usually her, and it's always a woman, into some sort of architecture, usually European architecture. Either there's something sort of current, so it looks almost like Soviet and modern and very heavy and concrete, or something 19th century and kind of intimidating and Viennese. And she often wraps her body around the curves of concrete or creates certain angles to a setting. So she uses her body to create an angle to a door or an angle to a plaza or some such. Or also in some of the pieces, she puts herself into a natural environment. So she has some pieces where she's at the beach and she sort of creates yet another sand dune with her body, the way she configures it. Also, most of the pictures are marked with black lines or red lines, which are produced in the dark room, or she draws them after they've been developed. And this adds like another layer of strangeness to the series. And I thought the fact that she draws these geometric shapes over these images, which are often triangles, lines, or squares, in this way she's sort of teasing out the latent geometry in the pictures, which brings us to the question of, what is the instinct of architecture or constructivism or geometric abstraction or minimalism to turn the world, which is a very sort of fluid, organic place, into a grid. And I think it's this instinct to cover the biological world, which is unmanageable and chaotic in its forms, with a grid or sort of some sort of geometric approximation of that is what she's going after by taking her body and inserting it into these spaces. So I thought now I would just actually read a couple specific descriptions that I wrote of the spaces. And then I thought I would talk about some other things that the other critics and writers have written about the work, as well as the artist herself, and talk about that a bit. So, title, Body Configuration, Dune Landscape, Date Unknown, Black and White Photograph, Dimensions Framed, 56 by 79 centimeters. A female figure, the artist perhaps, crouches face down on her knees in a ground of dark seagrass, her head resting against the sand, arms protecting her head. In the distance, pale dunes. Further, a white stripe of sky. The long, even horizontals of the image add up to a kind of gray scale. Dark stripe of seagrass, pale stripe of sand dune, palest stripe of sky. And in the foreground, the artist, crouched low like a small dune of her own, a small wave of seagrass rising up behind her like the thick eyelashes of some large, soft-eyed animal. Title, Rounding Off, Date 1976. Black and white photograph. The artist in cuffed dark jeans, a tight t-shirt, and espadrilles that wrap like ribbons around her ankles, lies in the gutter of a rounded curb in the street. Her face turns away from us, invisible. Her body arches backwards, following the gentle curve of the concrete curb. Curve of the concrete curb. Shit, I should start this one again. Okay. Title, Rounding Off, Date 1976, Black and White Photograph. The artist in cuffed dark jeans, a tight t-shirt, and espadrilles that wrap like ribbons around her ankles, lies in the gutter in the street. Her face turns away from us, invisible. Her body arches backwards, following the gentle curve of the concrete curb. Her arms lifted up and stretched backwards, lengthening her form so as to follow the street as far as she possibly can. Above the curb, on the sidewalk, the base of a street lamp is visible. Five lines, perhaps drawn on the photograph with ink after it was printed, start at the rounded base of the street lamp, then striate outwards, like sun rays or the points of a compass, until they touch the artist. The first line reaches out to her hands, the second to her elbow, the third to her waist, the fourth to the back of her knees, the fifth to her ankles, in their ribbon state. Title: Body Configuration Series. Date: 1982. Black and white photograph. This image is aerial. We look down on the artist as she arches her body backwards around the gentle curving swoop of a curve. Her eyes are closed. Her chin tilts upward as she presses her head back to touch the cold concrete. Below her body, a field of cobblestones, small, square, worn, and even as teeth. They look like a mosaic from this angle. Above her body, the dirty white concrete pour of the street, rough, heavy, languorous, aloof. Her dark hair, dark turtleneck, dark pants make a slash of black against the pale, dirty tones of the street. Her eyes are closed, her face relaxed, her chin tilted just so. So by doing this, I thought it was just interesting to sort of put into language the basic elements of these photographs, which pretty much stay the same as the artist makes them. She puts her body in some sort of architectural setting that is cold and aloof and is made more so by the fact that the images are in black and white, and then inserts her own body, which she tries to also keep as aloof as possible. Her face is often turned away, serious, or her eyes closed. But the fact that her body is there obviously changes the situation completely. And I think obviously this was her point in doing this. And I just wanted to also, I'm gonna stop for a second actually. I'm not sure how I'm going to make the transition to the next one so we can edit it. Okay. So a lot of critics, of course, have written about this series, but I'm very interested in what the American art critic Roberta Smith wrote in the New York Times in 2000. She wrote, in these images, Ms. Export seems to be haunting Vienna, inserting herself into places that are overpowering and by definition male. In the end, her protest strikes the viewer as anything but passive. And I think I like this idea of haunting, but it doesn't seem quite right. It doesn't match for me the rigor of the images. It turns Valley Export into a kind of Miss Havisham. And I think the point of Valley Export, of this series in total, is that she's not sort of a haunting female. She's not a haunting female haunting these male works of architecture. I think the fact that she's a woman and the fact that the architecture is often seen as male is the point, but it also isn't. And something that Valley Export has said about her name, which she created herself, she says export means always and everywhere. That is to say, exporting myself. She said, I created the name to export myself, to bring ideas out of the harbor. And I think, in a way, her body is doing this in these pieces. She's bringing the ideas of the architecture, which is usually mute and unsaid, which is obviously metaphors that can be applied to architecture, but also to a sort of gendered male. She's doing the opposite, where she's sort of teasing out the meanings, both in terms of gender and in terms of aesthetics and in terms of architectonics. So as I started doing some research into Valley Export after I first became acquainted with her at my mother's house, I was struck by the fact of her name, which she writes all in cap letters, and which she created herself, which is not her was not her husband's at the time's name or her father's name. And she created a whole new name to sort of distance herself from that patriarchal lineage or structure. And my mother had also renamed herself when she was in her 20s to also separate herself from her family and her father. And when she named me, she was insistent that I have her last name, not my father's, which my father was fine with. But she also left a space where she didn't give me a middle name. She left a space so that if I felt like naming myself in the future, I would have a space in which to do it. So I think this idea of naming had always been very important in our house. So the fact that I came upon Valley Export's work at my mother's house, and then the way Valley Export had also named herself, that was quite important, had to do with her body of work, really interested me. And I think as sort of the next few years went on, I think this series, Body Configurations and Architecture, really stayed with me. And after college, in which I studied both poetry and art, I started writing poetry more seriously, and I ended up going to graduate school for poetry. And yet at the same time, I was also working for a contemporary art documentary series in New York. So art was very much part of my days, and then I would go home and poetry was my nights. It was sort of this weird sort of dual existence. And I ended up writing a long poem about body configurations in architecture called that, actually, and it was the first poem that I got published. And I think on purpose, in a very weird way, I didn't keep the poem. And I tried to find it for this talk, but I have no idea where it is. But the poem sort of starts out very personally, and I end up talking about the Southern California landscape where I grew up with my mother, and the long horizontals and that dictate both the sea and the sand and the mountains, but also the architecture. The architecture in Southern California, where I grew up, was very much embedded in the 70s, in sort of a 70s, like faux modernist style. You could look to the case study houses, and I think those would be a big influence. But it was sort of diluted, and yet that really was these sort of this like long, low slung, earth-colored architecture was all around me when I was growing up. So I would look at Valley Export's Body Configurations and Architecture series, and I would see the architecture she was putting her body against, which was either this sort of 19th century Viennese ideal or this much sort of like darker Cold War architecture that was lots of concrete and huge plazas, very heavy. And in terms of my own life, I think I could almost imagine my body doing the same thing, but in a Southern California landscape where you have sea and sand and mountains in very close proximity to each other, and in between them, these long, lone, slung houses and buildings. So this was what this poem sort of was about. And I think this came out in some magazine in maybe 2001. And then I completely forgot about it. And last year when I was moving to Basel, I was going through some of my mom's books and packing some of them to bring here. And this poem fell out. And I started reading it, and then I stopped and I put it back in the book because I felt like, I don't know, I felt like at this point I was sort of done with this series, and maybe I was done with Valley Export for a period of time. And then I came here. And in talking about this, I realized that this series hasn't left me, that it's still very much in my mind. And I wish that I had brought that poem so I could read an excerpt from it, but I can't. So I think that in a way that this talk is sort of my substitute for that. And I also, I feel like in a way, my interest in Valley Export also went back to my interest in my mother and those same kinds of feminist ideals and the way they might merge with your aesthetics in terms of architecture and visual art and literature. So I think in a way that poem wasn't just for Valley Export, but it was also for my mother. And I think the same thing for this talk. This is also sort of an homage to the woman who introduced me to Valley Export in the first place, which was my mother. That's it.
Make yourself comfortable. Tomorrow's another big day. You'll need your rest. See, you've got to find yourself a little water to sleep on. That keeps you safe. So, I promised I'd tell you more about flying earlier. Now's a good time. I hope you've enjoyed your day. It's bedtime now. Water's a good way to land, and it's just as nice to sleep on, too. Sure, it's not a proper nest with down and everything, but it's what we've got to use when we're traveling. Flying, yes, I love it, and I'm glad we get plenty of chances to do it. The landing can be difficult, but it's a small price to pay for getting to be up there. There's some dangers, obviously, hunters and all, but what can you do? The way we follow the warm weather, we sure get a lot of practice, though. Even at this time of year, when you can feel the change. Remember how much cooler it was where we stopped last night in Penetang? I'm glad it's warmer here. Usually is. Toronto. That's tonight's stop. I actually grew up not far from here. I don't know if you know the Bluffs. Well, I guess you're too young to have had the chance to go there yet. Anyway, that was the place. That's where I got my name, right? Gandhi. My mother got into all things Indian when she lived around here, around there. Great people all around here and there, too. She really loved the stories she'd heard about that one man in particular. Gandhi was someone a lot of people liked very much because he talked about how people could be nicer to each other. We can definitely appreciate that, just like when we let people fly at the back of the V when they get tired. It made me wonder whether there are any geese in India, but it's hard to find out about these things. We meet people from all over, but most of them are going north and south, not east and west. But I love it around here. There's people that come from all over. That's why Cassie and I like giving our children names from far-off places, just like my mother did, right? Harold, Manuel, Roman, Devon. Names from all over. My kids are all older than you are now. You were just a gosling until recently, I can tell. I can see you've still got your fresh white plumage. Enjoy it while you can. You're all black, gray, and brown after that. Colors. You really get a sense for them with what we do. When you pass over everything while we're traveling, you get to see the trees changing both ways, turning green one way, orange the other. A lot of the trees are still green here, though. The rest are as gold as sunlight itself. What a warm color for cool weather. It's all change. But every year is sort of the same, too, so which is it? Does everything stay the same, or is it always changing? It's too dark to see much color now, but look up at the stars. Now's the time to appreciate them. When you're flying, you're just looking down and to the sides. So look up now while you've got the chance. Yes, I know it's late. I can see you're sleepy. Me too. I think everyone else is asleep already. Isn't it quiet? I love flying. And I love a rest too. Gives me energy for another day up there. It means I can sleep and dream about more flying. Do you dream about flying? I thought so. You've got to learn how to fly in your dreams just like you learned in your waking life. It's pretty close. Just use the wings in your mind. There, taking off and landing aren't that hard at all. And when you're up there, it's just a long, slow rhythm, nice and easy. I can tell you're wanting to try it now, aren't you? Just focus on it, right? Flap, glide, flap, glide. Just imagine you're up there in the V looking down on everything. Even though you can't sleep until you put your head under your wing, keep on flying with the wings in your mind. Now just keep thinking about the movement. Flap, glide, flap, glide, flap, glide. That's right. That's flying. Bonne nuit.
to you.
Radio Arthur.
On the occasion of the exhibition of Anthony Whitewater's Hush, My Dear, together with the Forever Ending Story, we are having a talk with the artist itself through Skype, and it's speaking myself, Valentina, as well as Claudio Vogt and Anthony Whitewater.
I hear you a little bit muffled, so I don't know. I think it'll be okay.
So you have to talk more than we do.
Okay. I'll do my best. I can speak.
That's great.
I'm a good speaker.
That's good, because actually we don't know so much about you, I think. Maybe
we just know
you have this A+ in art, you know?
Right.
Your CV? What about that? Can you maybe tell us more?
Yes, that piece came about intuitively. I think the idea began in art school. I have some issues with authority, first of all, not only educational authority and teachers, but also I hate police, and I distrust the government, organized religion doesn't make much sense to me. My father was part of Solidarność, in Poland in the early 80s, and that's the reason why I'm in Canada. Because in 81 he was jailed along with a large portion of the male population in Poland, and when he got out he had no job and he had 4 children, so he and my mother decided to emigrate here to Toronto. I grew up in Toronto but live in Vancouver now. So I have my issues with authority and a distrust for authority, and I guess just after I graduated in 2000 from my bachelor's at the University of Toronto, I had this idea that I put up these signs. I went back to my studio and I put up these signs saying, fine art tutoring. Like, are you having a problem with your painting? Do you need help with understanding conceptual art? Former student will teach you how to how to speak to your teachers, how to present in a crit, how to write better essays, etc. And a couple people got in touch with me, but nothing really happened, and I didn't really pursue the idea further. And the idea stuck with me, and a couple years later, I got an idea to write a handbook, and again, nothing happened. And then I had this opportunity to make a catalog for Art Metropole where I was working, and I just put in a short story. You know, there was no subject in school which I didn't love. I got an A+ in French. I got an A+ in science. I got an A+ in art when you finally open the poster really large. And then after that, I started making little buttons. And then after that, I actually wrote the book, which was published in 2007 by Standard Form Press in Toronto. And so it's just a way of really addressing the problems, I think, associated with the government now in Canada raising tuition and making education inaccessible for the poor, for people who don't have money, and talking about those issues and how art can somehow create a space for healing and for somehow healing this problem. It's kind of a long answer, but
so you kind of really believe in art, right? In a transformational potential somehow?
Yes, I do. Powerful energy, and I think it's it has the potential to be as powerful as science, which is working on sort of very concrete physical problems of how to, I don't know, create a cure for AIDS or cancer or any disease. It has the potential, but it also has the potential to operate on the scale of religion to sort of heal a person's soul. It also has the potential to operate on the level of sport, on the highest level, to somehow engage a person's physical body. So, you know, it can work on physical, on mental, and on spiritual levels. I don't think many of it does. I think a lot of contemporary art is inoperable. It just doesn't work. It's very formal. It remains very formal, somehow stuck in this modernist conceptual logic where it just becomes about the object and doesn't really do anything except be its own container.
It's also noticeable that you often use text in your work. There's also a lot of statements. For example, on your first side of your homepage, there is a text of the artist David Hammons. It seems to be almost like a manifesto.
Yes.
Or there's another work of you in which you write in neon letters, it just says, "Let's hope." Is there like a certain potential in using text, or how comes that you use text so often?
I think because text is direct. You know, if I say, I think in part it's because it's direct, because I can say "let's hope" directly and you can't confuse the message. The piece still has a high level of ambiguity and allows a person to construct their own meaning, and many texts do. However, the meaning can't be misconstrued. I find a lot of art, and even the way I was educated, you're told to give a high level of ambiguity, which is good because it allows this amazing space for the viewer to enter and construct their own meaning and somehow be touched in their own way. But at the same time, what it does a lot of times is it creates empty statements. Mm-hmm. Statements that are so invested with conceptual rhetoric and argumentation on a intellectual level that you go and you look at it and you really don't know why things are the way they are unless you do an amazing amount of research. And most people, when they go to a gallery, unfortunately don't spend that time to investigate. And text, I think, allows a very quick way of getting in touch with a person. And so maybe they can read it right away and understand it, absorb it really quickly and not investigate it any further at the time. But maybe it stays with them and they think about it later rather than somehow having to try and understand it all right there in front of them and try to come up with everything. I think also our culture, even though it's a very, very complicated visual culture with internet and advertising bombarding us and everybody has a digital camera, everybody's a photographer, I think many of us are visually illiterate and we don't know how to process images properly. And I think maybe text becomes a shorthand for me.
Do you somehow think you have a certain, mistrust in pictures?
No, I don't think so at all.
Because I just see that on the other side, that a lot of works of you seem to have this like really iconographic, like symbolic side.
Yeah, that's true. I don't have a mistrust of images at all. I think more so than anything, and the employment of simple texts and icons and symbols is a way of speaking to the audience in a way that they will understand. I can come up with my own symbols and my own way of speaking and my own vocabulary, but that doesn't mean anything if I can't communicate to you. An artist is a communicator who should somehow have a message for viewers. So I try to use a lot of universal symbols and ways of being able to speak to somebody in Vancouver who will understand the symbol, but also to somebody in Basel and somebody in Beijing and or in Moscow as a way of shorthand and making it accessible. I don't want to make it so complicated that, again, you're searching too much for meaning.
So, for example, considering the work at Hashmadir, there's on your website too, there's this photograph, and I'm not sure if it's you or is it just a person in this RCMP uniform, which
yes.
Also appears in different works of you. So could you maybe tell us a bit more about this... what is it, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police?
Yes. That is me in the uniform of a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. And what I'm doing is I'm holding a Canada goose, and the goose is sleeping. And so I was sitting in a park on a kind of rainy day in Toronto in this kind of man-made stage, and what you don't see in the photo, but from the angle where the photo was taken, is there's a path, and so people would walk by, and sometimes they're talking really loud, and being dressed as a police officer gives me some kind of authority, and I would, you know, I would hush them, and I was like, shh, and when they looked at me, they don't understand, first of all, why there's an RCMP officer, but then I would point to the goose and I would say, you know, the goose is sleeping. You have to be quiet because the goose is sleeping. And so that was the performance. You know, the RCMP is Canada's FBI, KGB, kind of. There are very serious international police in Canada, and they do serious work, and they cooperate internationally with other police internationally to fight crime, which I can respect. However, they are the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and what that means is that they are a branch of police enforcement from London, England, because Canada is a colony. Even though we're independent, we're a colony of the British Empire. And there was a statistic published a few weeks ago that most of Canadians don't care about the Queen, they don't care about England. And so it becomes this remnant of the past from and a current historical symbol of Canada's identity. And they have these great red uniforms, which are they're not worn every day, they're worn ceremonially for special occasions. And it's just kind of, well, why? Like, why do you have to put on this great suit, pretend you're such an amazing police? You're just fighting crime. You know, it's very, it's kind of very arrogant, I think, to have a royal police, first of all. But then they dress up in these suits and they get on horses. And then there's 30 horses and they ride around in formation. And it's kind of like, well, you guys are just police officers. Why do you have to do all these special tricks? And it's almost like it's almost like a comedy in a way. And the symbol itself has been, in Canada, the subject of, you know, the symbol is used in movies. It's used in comic books. There's been comedies made with RCMP officers, and it's just a rich symbol, which speaks about nationalism, which a lot of my work is quite interested in.
I have here an excerpt of a text of you, which for me is somehow maybe to do with this Hashmadia project. And I, when I read this, even if it's maybe bad English, in this text, which is considering the work Chinook, I think, you say, there's a romance about belonging to a nation. It's desirable to belong to something, to a community, but even nations are ephemeral. In the Chinook, an attempt is made to reconcile a personal sense of nationalism, an outgrowth of three spores, an umbilical link to a fatherland, Polska, a physical tie to the diaspora of a global people, Polonia, and a tie to this land, your land and my land, from sea to shining sea, Canada, a country with the real, however unclear, sense of nationalism, a nationalism latent in comparison to Poland or Russia or the USA, for instance. Red and white, touches of blue, anthem lyrics, animals, simple symbols and icons create an imaginary or a creole of a dual, sometimes tribal citizen. And then going further, there's a romance about art.
I remember that text well. Would you like me to speak about that romance? I had a show in Los Angeles in October that addressed it quite directly. And what I did, I had no budget for the show. I had no travel budget. And I thought to myself, well, why do we do this? Why do artists do this if, you know, there's no money in it? We have to work other jobs in order to do art. And then you do something that you think has so much importance that it will last forever, like a mountain. And so what I did is I took the front door off the hinges and mounted it in the middle of the space, took the pins out of the door and put them on a pedestal, on a plinth, put on a short text on the wall, which in pencil, which said, "I'm so sure of it." I wrote it in 24 karat gold. And then I put a semicircle of a sun. You can see it on the website. So yeah. It's easier to see than for me to explain. But I think the romance I refer to about art is a kind of romantic notion that we can make something that lasts forever. We, in art history and in art making, we privilege the museum very highly. We think that, you know, if I make a painting and it will end up at the Kunsthaus in Zurich or the Tate Modern in London, then we have made it. And in 100 years, maybe it will be important and I can create history. And I think that's very naive and it's very romantic, because the rest of society, business and corporations have even understood that it's important that we make and produce material objects as well as processes that are environmentally friendly, which don't last forever, because we don't want things to last forever. So we recycle paper and we recycle plastic and we recycle glass as a way of reusing. And art is still somehow stuck in its own self-importance about creating something which will last forever. And I think that's a very a negative and romantic way of looking at it.
But at the same time, you use gold as a material very often in your work. And doesn't, has it the quality to staying valuable?
And so, last forever.
Yes, it does last forever, but it's also easily to melt down and it can change form easily. Now, I use gold because it's a very rich material, not in the sense that it's rich in a valuable sense, but it's valuable because it has so many associations. Gold is interesting because it's the only yellow metal. Gold is also an element. Gold is also not a color on the spectrum. Yellow is a color, but gold isn't. Gold appears to be valuable in a material sense. We value it. It's precious. It also comes from the depths of the earth. It has to be mined for. It has to be worked hard for. But then it's also something which is traded and reported on TV. So it's traded on the stock market, and then on TV, on the news, they tell you every day how much it's worth today. But it's also a metal. It's cold. It will not keep you warm. So it has all these associations to cultural properties and social factors. And its use allows me to speak about values, whether they be how we value art or how we value objects or how we value nationalism, that sort of thing. And I continue to use gold, and I only use gold. I don't often use like gold ink or gold marker. I try to use gold. And I think, now that I'm speaking about it, the other association gold has is, of course, to science and religion. Because in science, gold is used because it It is a metal which can be flattened down to one atom thick, and it's used for physics experiments to pass atoms through and shoot atoms through. But it's also a symbol which is very strong in the Catholic faith, which I was raised in, but also in other faiths. But in Catholicism, you go to almost any Catholic church and there will be lots of gold everywhere. So it's a way of making associations to the soul, a person's soul.
I would like to ask another question about this, you called it a direct message. You hear me?
Yes.
Good. Because also in Hush My Dear, you work with so many other artists, and everyone is bringing his own contexts in this piece of art. So don't you think that, how do you organize to create a direct message if you bring so many different medias and other artists into your pieces?
I think the direct message comes out of the process, and or it's embedded in the end product, as in the same way that a mining company will work on extracting gold from rock, and then getting different people involved in it is a way of making a better product than I can, because even though I am intelligent, I'm not the smartest person in the world. And when I work with other people, I have one idea and you may have another idea, but between us, there's a third idea that we cannot conceive if it's not conceived together. And in that process, something actually better comes out of the process than we could have imagined initially. And I don't know if the collaborative aspect and the direct message is in confrontation with one another. I don't think that is. I think the collaboration actually allows a more direct message somehow to come out. And it's not, for me, it's not a very rigid and rigorous process. I don't work that way. I think I work far more intuitively, and if it feels right, then I go and do it. And that's how the Hush My Dear record was made. I just went with my intuition and what felt right.
But there's also kind of a reference to another artist, and it's Michael Snow.
Yes.
I just saw that there was this work of him, which is called Flight Stop.
Flight Stop.
Did you knew this work in the beginning?
Absolutely. Flight Stop is Toronto's most famous sculpture. It hangs in an arcade of a shopping mall. It's a beautiful work. So the importance for me about it is it's probably the first work of modern art that I saw as a child in Canada, but probably ever, because you just go to this mall to do shopping, to buy shoes or whatever. And so I probably saw this piece when I was 6 or 7 years old for the first time. And I mean, I've seen it 1,000 times. And it's just a really elegant, simple work of Canada geese made out of fiberglass. And they have photos, hand-tinted photos applied to them. And the geese, there's a flock of geese, and they're in the process of landing. You know, I did the Hush My Dear performance with the RCMP costume and the Canada Goose. Using the Canada Goose made me realize that I have this that I somehow made a link from my own interest about nature to this art historical marker of this local history in Toronto to Michael Snow's flight stop. And so I asked him if, you know, I got this idea to do this story, and I thought, wow, it'd be great if Michael Snow would voice it. And so I asked him, and he said yes. And I think for me, making this kind of connection to art history is valuable, but it does it in my own way, because I think art which makes references to art history is very, 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 very common, to the point where it's so boring. You know, like, I know artists who have made, let's take Jonathan Monk, for instance. I like Jonathan Monk's work, but he's a good example because people will know his work. He mines conceptual art. He mines conceptual artists and remakes conceptual art in his own way, because he has this stance that nothing new can be made. So all he's doing a lot of the time is remaking what has already been made. And I think it's super boring. And he's not the one, he's a good example, but he's not the only one. There's so many artists who do this, who for whatever reason cannot use their own intuition and way of being to make art. I'm not saying unique art, but just their own art, and rely on this moment in the 70s of conceptualism to somehow embed themselves within that history. I mean, even Damien Hirst does it now with his new paintings, which reference Francis Bacon so directly that you're just like, Damien, you're an amazing artist. You're so creative. Why do you have to rip off Francis Bacon? Give me a break. There's something powerful in it, and that's why artists do it. Making this connection to art history is very powerful. You know, Marcel Duchamp said that making art is like playing chess with all of art history. And he's very right. You do that. But then how can you make these links and connections to art history without just being so direct and so obvious and so boring? And so having a reverence for art history and the people who created a scene in Toronto and in Canada, and Michael Snow being one of the most eminent artists of that scene, it just really made sense to ask him to voice this idea. I mean, the idea came first, Michael Snow came later, and so the story of Flight Start, as I've called it, references directly to the sculpture, but it creates a whole new narrative rather than rehashing a narrative or the potential of Flight Stop. I think it goes to a completely different place, and it also involves Michael Snow directly as a producer in the piece, not as as a bystander, like the way Jonathan Monk will reuse Chris Burden. And then, you know, Chris Burden has no say in it. Jonathan Monk just reappropriates a conceptual master, and the conceptual master has no say in it. He's just creating a new product. Whereas I think I've made a link to art history, but also to community, but also just a genuine human link. I think it's also important, sorry to break your concentration there, to speak about the B-side of the record, which is a song.
What?
By a singer originally from Vancouver who's now living in Paris. Her name is Ndidi Onugulu, who is a contemporary blues singer, a soul singer. And she's written a song inspired by her kind of fear when she tries to speak French in Paris. She's learning French, and her heart starts to beat really hard when she tries to speak French. So she's written a song about, you know, learning something new and trying to keep her heart quiet and to stay cool and collected. And beyond it being a very beautiful song, I think music already does this, something that art can't do. It's very, very kind of ephemeral and pure. It cannot last forever. And at the same time, it has a sort of direct purpose. We put on songs, or we turn on the radio sometimes just to hear a song to help it revive us. And I think, you know, the best works of art do that. And that's what I hope my art can do as well. Maybe I should have been a musician.
Radio Arthur.
Und nun zum letzten Teil der Sendung. Anfang November hielt Christian Croft eine Lecture im Plugin und stellte dort unter anderem das Projekt GSN, Generative Social Networking, vor, das er 2006 gemeinsam mit Andrew Schneider entwickelt hat. Es ist ein Programm, mit dem er sich über Bluetooth in die Telefonbücher beliebiger Handybenutzer hackte und quasi automatisierte Verwechslungskomödien hervorrief. Gleichzeitig eine Parodie auf die Kommunikationsrituale des Telefonierens, gleichzeitig die unheimlichen Gefahren eines naiven Zustands des ständig Vernetztseins. Wir spielen nun die Audioversion dieses wunderbar amerikanischen Vortrags.
Thank you all so much for being here. Like Rafael said, my name is Christian Croft. It's really a pleasure to be here speaking at Pronto. It's really awesome that we have this festival that's totally dedicated to telephony projects. I've made several projects in this arena to date. And unfortunately, back home when I tell people that I make art projects that involve telephones, people give me a lot of befuddled reactions. They're like, what do you mean that you make art with telephones? So I try to explain a bit more to them, because I'm paranoid that they're probably thinking some things along the lines of felt stuffed telephones or huge art car telephones. So I bring them back to the table to give them a better context into the types of projects that I'm making with telephones. One project that is in this exhibition that I did with Asterisk is called Generative Social Networking. And it was sort of the first product of my introduction with this technology. Andrew Schneider, who collaborated with me on the project, he couldn't be here, unfortunately. He and I made GSN shortly after discovering open source telephony. So what does this project do? What is GSN all about? The project itself is trying to poke fun at a society that's filled with emerging technologies that we feel that people don't really understand. It also explores the darker consequences of people's obsession with staying connected all the time. Now, GSN came right about the time when Bluetooth technology became ubiquitous in people's cell phones. And at the time, most people didn't really know what Bluetooth was. They didn't know it was this wireless open gateway that other people could connect to your device. And the cell phone manufacturers hadn't been very diligent about making it very secure. And so Andrew and I, we capitalized on this vulnerability in Bluetooth and figured out a way to actually steal people's contact lists wirelessly without their permission. And a video about how we do this is in the exhibition, but I'm also going to show it to those of you who haven't seen it now.
Hello, Moto. Generative social networking. And it's what you need.
We're here in New York City, the most important place in the world, and also the most connected. All these people walking around with all this information, but still, it's not enough. Not everyone's connected. People in my contact list. My mother doesn't know my dog groomer. My sister doesn't know my drug dealer. How do I rectify this? I need to get those guys connected.
Using special Bluetooth technology, I can scan the devices. This is a match made in heaven.
One more command line. They're talking.
Thanks to Linux, we're able to use open source technology to gather your information. Equipped with just a computer, a GSN task force can find cell phones in an area by scanning for their Bluetooth names. If your phone is in discoverable mode, then it's shouting out its name in public. And here at GSN, we're ready to listen. Your phone is announcing itself, even underground, on the subway. You don't need to be connected to the cell network for GSN to connect to you.
Oh, no service. It's okay. We don't need the cell network to get you networked. We're just the Bluetooth network, and everyone on your phone is talking to everyone on everyone else's phone. You're not as well, you know it or not. You're always networking. Way to go. We're working hard, 24/7, for you. You don't even need to be with your phones. While you're working out in the gym, in the sauna, in the pool, in the weight room, or in here, the locker room, networking your phones for you.
So gathering people's cell phone contacts is just the first step of GSN. And it was actually pretty frightening to discover just how easy it was for us to do this. Within 1 week after figuring out the process of doing this via Bluetooth, we had amassed about 20 different people's cell phone contact lists. And with all the data that we'd gathered, we kept noticing that people had about way more than 100 numbers on their phones, which seemed to us like way more contacts than one could maintain stable relationships with. And that's kind of where the seed of GSN began. I mean, how many contacts are people's close friends, and how many are just one-time encounters? And we thought, well, wouldn't it be funny if we could introduce the members of a contact list to each other without the phone owner themselves having to be involved in the process? So we constructed a telephony application that connected all these people together. The system works by taking the first contact of a person's phone book and dialing them and recording their response. This response is then played back through the system in a separate call to the second contact in that person's list. Now this chain continues all the way through all the numbers in the list. If this is a little fast for you, I'm going to show an example video of the system at work on just one person's contact list that we found.
Hello, Moto.
Yeah.
Who's this?
Okay, this is... Oh, we're trying to get to touch them.
You called my phone.
No, I did not. You called mine.
Heiko?
I'm sorry? Are you trying to get in touch with somebody? Because you're trying to dial the wrong number. Hello?
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 Who's this?
Hello?
Yeah?
Yeah?
Who is it?
Yeah.
You tell me your name, wasn't it?
Okay, this is... We're trying to get to touch with.
Oh, you called me.
No, I did not. You called mine. I said you... I'm sorry?
Yeah? I didn't call you.
Are you trying to get in touch with somebody? Because you're trying to dial the wrong number.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Hello?
Bye.
Hello?
Who is it?
Hello?
Can you tell me your name, who is it?
This is Chris. Who is this?
I don't know, you called me.
I don't know if I called you or not. Oh,
sorry?
What's your number?
Yeah?
I'm sorry?
I didn't call you.
Oh, okay. I was called wrong.
Okay, no,
that's
fine. Bye.
Hello?
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 Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello, who is it? Hello, who is it?
This is Chris. Who is this?
Erica? Can I play phone?
I don't know if I called you or not. Oh, what's your number? I'm sorry?
Excuse me?
Oh, okay. I must have called the wrong number.
Hi. Bye. Travis? Hello? Who's there? Hello? This is Hannah Schrader. Who's there? Hello? 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 Hello, who is it? Who's there? Erica? Can I play phone?
Hello?
Hello? Hello, who's there? This is Hannah Schrader. Who's there?
How are you? Here's Klaus.
Hello? Who's there?
I think not the right connection. Good night.
So we haven't made a video of all 100 numbers yet. That might be a little boring towards the end, but it's kind of uncanny about how well that works and how entertaining it can be. But of course, none of this is legal, what we're doing. We're very aware of this. It violates all sorts of privacy issues, and that's kind of the idea. Because as long as the technology has loopholes, hackers are always going to find ways to use them. The US government, as well as other governments, are keenly interested in them as well, which we like to draw attention to. And just to close about generative social networking before I move on to my other projects, the loopholes that we were exploiting in Bluetooth that made GSM possible have now been closed on newer cell phone models. But the key to its success, was that many people never knew the risks of that default setting that they had on their cell phone's discoverable mode. So that's sort of what the GSN tagline continues to be about. We tell people to stay discoverable, keep your phones or your devices in those default settings, and just keep any technology you use in that state that the makers of it ship it to you, and trust that your life will see more convenience and not more consequences.
Radio Arthur, for further information, visit us at www.radioarthur.ch. For requests and comments, email us on info@radioarthur.ch.